This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Stephen Walt, is the co-author of a controversial new book about the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. Walt and his co-author, John Mearsheimer, argue that America gives a remarkable and disproportionately high level of material and diplomatic support to Israel, and often that support is not in America's best interests. They say the explanation for this relationship with Israel is the political influence of the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. That lobby includes AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Walt and Mearsheimer first outlined their views in an article that caused quite a stir when it was published last year in the London Review of Books. Their new book is called The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. The head of the Anti-Defamation League, Abraham Foxman, has countered their argument with his own new book called The Deadliest Lies. We'll hear from him later. My guest, Stephen Walt, is a professor of international affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. His co-author, John Mearsheimer, co-directs the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. Stephen Walt, welcome to Fresh Air. What is the Israel lobby that you're talking about? What groups are you including in the larger group that you define as the Israel lobby?
The Israel lobby, as we define it, is a loose coalition of individuals and organizations that actively work to shape American foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. A lobby is defined by its political agenda, not by ethnicity or religion. It includes both Jewish Americans and non-Jews. It is certainly not a cabal or a conspiracy or anything like that. It's simply a set of groups that make up a large interest group. And it has a sort of core of organizations like AIPAC and the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and Christian Zionist groups like Christians United for Israel. And then it has a sort of broader penumbra of supporters, people who are generally, pro-Israeli. And the key here is these are both individuals and organizations that actively work, that devote some amount of their daily lives, either professional or personal, to trying to move American foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction.
And what policies are considered pro-Israel? Like, what are the main policies that you think the lobby favors?
I think the key group, one point to emphasize is that groups in the lobby don't agree on every single issue. This is not a hierarchical organization with a central leadership that gives orders to all the members. So there are real disagreements. Some of them, for example, favor a two-state solution. Other groups in the lobby are opposed to that and think Israel ought to control all of the occupied territories as well as Israel proper itself. So there's some disagreements. But I think the unifying themes within the different organizations is first that the United States should give nearly unconditional support to Israel, sort of economic and military aid and diplomatic support, really no matter what Israel does. Second, they want the United States to back Israel versus the Palestinians and not to put much, if any, pressure on Israel to give the Palestinians a viable state. And then finally, most of the groups in the lobby, and the most important ones, the most influential ones, want the United States to take a fairly confrontational stance towards Israel's various adversaries, whether that be, Syria, Iraq under Saddam Hussein, Iran today, or groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. They want the United States, again, to use its power to try and do what we can to deal with those adversaries.
Now, you say that as an example of the pro-Israel lobby's power, Israel gets a disproportionate amount of support from the United States. Give us some examples of what you mean.
Oh, well, Israel is the largest recipient of American foreign aid and has been for quite some time, since the mid-70s. It gets, roughly $3 billion in economic and military assistance every year. It turns out the actual figure is a little bit higher than that because that's just the sort of straight aid. There's a lot of other things that add up to a little bit more. It also gets consistent diplomatic support. The United States tends to back Israel whenever there are critical resolutions in either the Security Council or the General Assembly of the United Nations. Certainly comes to Israel's aid in wartime, as it has done, for example, in the most recent war in Lebanon, where the United States took Israel's side, even though many other democracies around the world were quite critical of the Israeli response and its disproportionate character during that war.
Where does the lobby's money come from?
Private donations from Americans. AIPAC, I think, gets almost all of its money from individual contributions from Americans. And that underscores, by the way, a very important point. There's nothing illegitimate about this. This is the way American politics works. The groups in the lobby act no differently than the farm lobby, than labor unions, than the National Rifle Association, the AARP. American politics is built on the interplay and the competition among interest groups. And there's nothing illegitimate about people who are highly sympathetic to Israel organizing and advocating policies they think will benefit Israel, and that they, I'm sure, also believe will benefit the United States. One of the central arguments in our book is that they're simply wrong about this. The policies they are advocating have been both harmful to the American national interest, but in many cases unintentionally harmful to Israel as well.
You argue in your book that Israel was a strategic asset during the Cold War, but now it's becoming a liability. What do you mean?
You can make a pretty good case that Israel was a strategic asset during the Cold War, largely by helping the United States deal with various Soviet client states in the Middle East, by sort of humiliating them in warfare, by forcing the Soviet Union to expend a lot more resources, backing its various clients. You can make a case that Israel was an asset. The problem is that the Cold War is now over, and unconditional support for Israel complicates America's relationships in the Middle East and elsewhere in a whole series of ways. First of all, it's one of the things that fuels anti-Americanism throughout the Islamic and Muslim world. Again, it's not the existence of Israel per se or the fact the United States supports Israel, but the fact that we give Israel such unconditional support that drives this problem at the same time that Israel is treating the Palestinian people in such a brutal fashion. That causes a problem for us. Second, it is clearly part of what has inspired terrorist groups like al-Qaeda. It's not their only grievance, and if all the problems between Israel and the Palestinians were solved tomorrow, some of these groups would still be out there. But it clearly aids their recruiting. It's something they can use, and it's clearly a motivation for some of them, and they've made that clear. And finally, it complicates our diplomacy in all sorts of ways. First of all, our allies in Europe and elsewhere often regard our Middle East policy as somewhat one-sided. And other countries in the region that would like to move closer to the United States, would like to cooperate with us, say, in dealing with countries like Iran, find it more difficult to do that because we are seen as so unconditionally and closely allied with Israel. So for all of those reasons, Israel is no longer a strategic asset. It's really actually a strategic liability. The United States should still support it, but not because it makes us safer to do so, but rather because we support the existence of Israel on essentially moral grounds.
Yeah, well, Israel is the only real democracy in the Middle East. It's our ally in the war on terror. And historically, it's been surrounded by enemies, and in that sense, the Israeli people are always very vulnerable. So talk a little bit about how that figures into your view of the American-Israeli relationship.
Well, my co-author and I both strongly support Israel's right to exist, and in fact, its right to exist in security and prosperity. We don't question that at all. Yes, it's true that Israel has faced a difficult environment, which is not particularly surprising, but it's true now that Israel's security situation is much better than it's ever been, even allowing for the problems it still has from Palestinian terrorism. It has a peace treaty with Egypt, a peace treaty with Jordan. The Arab peace plan of 2002, which was recently reaffirmed, shows that the rest of the Arab world would be willing to make peace with Israel if it could achieve a settlement vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And in a sense, it's only the continued Israeli presence in the occupied territories and the unwillingness to grant a Palestinian state, I think, that's preventing it from having an even more secure relationship with its neighbors. And the problem is we're not doing Israel any favors by continuing to give it unconditional support while it persists in policies that actually make Israel less secure.
Let's look at some of the instances in which you think that the pro-Israel lobby in the United States had a major impact on American policy in the Middle East. Why don't we start with the Iraq War? What impact do you think the Israel lobby had on the invasion of Iraq?
Well, we argue in the book that the Israeli lobby, and in particular the neoconservative faction, more sort of hardline groups within it, were critical to the American decision to invade Iraq. Now, that's not to say they were solely responsible, but we argue that absent their influence, the United States would have been much less likely to invade Iraq in 2003. This is not to say that they caused the war all by themselves. For example, we point out that although the neoconservatives had begun pushing for a war with Iraq in the late 1990s, they were unable to persuade Bill Clinton to do it. And although they were continuing to push, and although a number of prominent neoconservatives had important positions in the Bush administration, they were unable to persuade President Bush or Vice President Cheney to favor a war against Iraq in the first 9 months of the Bush administration. So they couldn't control American foreign policy or cause a war by themselves. After 9/11, however, after the terrorist attacks on 9/11, the political calculations change in a number of ways, and the neoconservatives in particular are right there with a solution. Let's go after Iraq. And eventually they persuade Vice President Cheney and President Bush to go along with it. Now,
can I just stop you for a second?
Yeah.
Some of the neoconservatives are Jewish, and I'll use just to name two, Bill Kristol and Paul Wolfowitz. But does that mean that they're part of what you describe as the pro-Israel lobby? Because you're talking about neoconservatives as if they're in intrinsically part of the pro-Israel lobby.
I think most of the neoconservatives are. All right, it's clear if you look at the major writings of neoconservatives, they are strongly devoted to the state of Israel. But this isn't strictly because they're Jewish. There are also a number of prominent neoconservatives, John Bolton, James Woolsey, and others, the late Gene Kirkpatrick, for example, who were not Jewish. And it gets back to a point I made earlier that you define the lobby not by ethnicity or by religion, but by a political agenda, by what's the set of policy prescriptions that you're proposing. The other key point to note here is that although key organizations in the lobby, like the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, Christians United for Israel, AIPAC, and others, all supported the Iraq War and in some cases, pushed for it in various ways, the broader American Jewish community was actually less supportive of going to war than the American people as a whole. Right. These organizations were pushing a policy that, in fact, American Jews tended to be less supportive of.
We're looking now at some of the policies that you think the pro-Israel lobby in America has been particularly influential in creating. What about last year's war in Lebanon? What role do you think the pro-Israel lobby in the United States played in that?
I believe the lobby quite unintentionally did considerable harm to both to American interests in the region, but also to Israeli interests. We had a situation where Israel had ongoing conflict with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, and Hezbollah had then staged an incident where they killed and captured some Israeli soldiers. And there was no question that Israel had the right to respond to that and indeed had a problem with Hezbollah sitting in southern Lebanon. The problem was that the response that Israel adopted to that, which was essentially a massive bombing campaign against southern Lebanon and other parts of Lebanon, was doomed to fail. Once the war started and it became clear that Israel's strategy wasn't working, we should have worked overtime to shut it down. Unfortunately,
what do you mean to shut it down?
To get a ceasefire immediately. Mm-hmm. In fact, what the United States government did during the war was backed Israel to the hilt, let Israel use American military stores that are stored in Israel to fight the war. We tried to slow the ceasefire negotiations down inside the United Nations to give Israel more time for the military campaign to operate. And we made a lot of supportive things. Congress passed a resolution overwhelmingly, I think, something 410-8, declaring that Israel should be allowed to do whatever was necessary, overwhelming measure of support.
My guest is Stephen Walt, co-author of the new book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Walt, co-author of the controversial new book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. The book argues that the U.S. gives a disproportionately high amount of aid to Israel and is uncritical of Israel because of the power of the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. I think you've been criticized by some people for being critical of Jewish Americans for having a dual loyalty, for being loyal to America, but also, feeling a loyalty to Israel, even when that loyalty to Israel may not be in America's best interests.
This is a very important subject. The point is that First of all, we don't accuse anyone of being disloyal to the United States. We recognize that in the United States, which is a melting pot society, many individuals have multiple loyalties and multiple attachments. That's to their families, to churches, and sometimes that includes an attachment to a foreign country for whatever set of reasons. It may be because of ancestry. It may be because you studied over there when you were in college or in high school. And in the United States, it's perfectly permissible for those multiple attachments to manifest themselves in politics. Americans can have dual citizenship. Americans can serve in foreign armies as long as we're not at war with the other country. So we think there's nothing wrong with people having an attachment to a foreign country, whether it's Cuban Americans, Irish Americans, Indian Americans, Jewish Americans. That's perfectly okay. And the point is we simply ought to acknowledge that openly. We believe people in the lobby, whether they're Jewish or not, are advocating policies they think are in America's interests and in Israel's interests. And what we ought to be talking about is whether the policies they are advocating are in fact good for us or good for Israel.
Now, your new book has just been published, but before the book, it was about 2 years ago, you wrote a very you wrote an article that was the basis of this book for that was published in the London Review of Books, and boy, did that generate controversy. this new book is, of course, generating controversy too, and you have said it is very difficult to talk about the pro-Israel lobby in the United States. I want you to share with us an example of what you have experienced in the aftermath of the publication of your article and the book that you think shows how difficult it is to talk about or to criticize the pro-Israel lobby.
I could give you several, and I want to underscore that to say that it's difficult to talk about it is not to say that it's impossible. The fact that we've published a book with a major publisher at this point suggests that it's possible to have the conversation. But there are a number of reasons why it's hard. I mean, first of all, if you are critical of Israeli policy or if you're critical of the influence of groups like AIPAC and others, you are virtually certain to be accused of being an anti-Semite. And, of course, that happened to us. We were accused by a wide variety of people. Of being anti-Semitic. This is nonsense, but it's the standard sort of smear tact that is often used when anyone wants to be critical. And by the way, that smear tactic is used because it immediately changes the subject. Instead of people talking about the actual substance of your claims, whether you're right or wrong, they start talking about what you are like as a person. It also deters lots of people from even raising possible questions because they don't want to get branded with that kind of an epithet. Most people are reluctant to touch this issue because they realize that you're going to get attacked, and the attacks are not going to be particularly gentlemanly. The problem, of course, is that if we can't talk about these subjects in a rather civilized and candid way, we're more likely to adopt policies that don't make much sense either because we haven't had a chance to argue them out openly. And if people feel like raising legitimate concerns about American foreign policy is somehow taboo or will carry a large personal price, we're not going to be able to have that kind of discussion.
A little later in our show, we're going to be hearing from Abraham Foxman, who's the head of the Anti-Defamation League, one of the groups that you include in the larger pro-Israel lobby in the United States. And his new book is in large part an answer to your book. And he says, I am not calling Mearsheimer and Walt anti-Semites, but I am saying that their article repeats and supports myths and beliefs that anti-Semites have peddled for centuries, thereby giving aid and comfort to some of the most despicable people in our society. And it does so by using half-truths, distortions, and outright falsehoods to prop up a general analysis that is dishonest and wrong. I know that bigoted individuals and groups will happily disseminate the Mearsheimer and Walt article. The anti-Semites are delighted with Mearsheimer and Walt's thesis and see in it support for much of what they believe. How would you respond to that?
First of all, although Mr. Foxman is not calling us anti-Semites in this book, he has done so in the past. He's said our book is a classic conspiratorial analysis and clearly stated that we were anti-Semitic. Second, what he's doing now in the book is essentially misrepresenting our argument. He's saying that we portray the lobby as all-powerful, that we think Jewish groups control our foreign policy. If you consider the subtitle of his book, is The Deadliest Lies is the title, and the subtitle is The Myth of Jewish Control. So the idea is that we're suggesting that Jews control our foreign policy. Of course, we never say that, but the goal is to make us think that we're sort of an updated version of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, this classic conspiracy theory, anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that was discredited, you know, long ago. So it's a rather subtle way of implying that we're, if not anti-Semitic, awfully darn close. And again, that's sort of the standard tactic here. You first misrepresent someone's argument, and then you smear people in that way. Now, the question is, are we then providing aid and comfort? I think there's no question that there will be some despicable extremists who will try to exploit what we've written. We have no control over how others want to misuse our book, but we've made it abundantly clear in the book how much we condemn anti-Semitism, how much we regard various extremists as despicable. And so if someone wants to try and use the book to advocate or to advance that kind of agenda, they're going to have to ignore some key elements in precisely what we say.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Stephen Walt is co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. He's a professor at Harvard. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.